The closer they came to the Abyssinian border, the more wild and grand the land became. Magnificent savannas gave way to forests of stately trees, interrupted by open glades of green grass. 25 days after they had left the Nile, they came upon the first herd of elephant. Closer to the towns and villages, these great animals had been ruthlessly pursued by ivory hunters, and had been forced to withdraw deeper into the wilderness. This herd was drinking and bathing at a pool in the Rahad River. The water was deep and broad, surrounded by fever trees with canary-yellow trunks. They heard the squealing and splashing from a great distance and manoeuvred downwind to climb the low koppie that overlooked the pool. From the summit they had a splendid view of the unsuspecting herd. It was made up of 50 or so cows with their offspring. There were 3 immature bulls with them, but they carried nondescript tusks. One of Osman Atalan's young warriors had not yet killed an elephant, in the classical manner, on foot and armed only with a sword. Osman described the technique to him. It was a masterly dissertation. Penrod listened with fascination. He had heard of this dangerous pastime in which the Agajirs earned their title, but had never seen its execution. Towards the end of his lecture, when Osman was pointing out the exact point on the back of the elephant's hind leg where the sword stroke must be aimed to sever the tendon, it occurred to Penrod that Osman was addressing him as much as the Arab novice. He dismissed this as an idle thought. The herd finished drinking and wandered away through the grove of fever trees. Osman let them go unmolested. They were not worthy of his steel. He ordered the Agajirs to mount up, and they rode back to the encampment. 3 days later they came across more elephant tracks. The Agajirs dismounted to study them and saw that they had been made by a pair of bulls. The pad marks were fresh, and one set was enormous. With animation they speculated among themselves as to the size and weight of ivory that the larger bull carried. Osman ordered them to remount and led them forward at a smart walk so that the sound of galloping hooves would not alarm and stampede the quarry. "They drank at the river early this morning, and now they are returning to the hills to take cover in the thickets of kitar thorns, where they feel secure," Osman said. As they approached the hills, they saw that the lower slopes were covered with the reptilian and venomous green thornbush, which contrasted with the brighter, fresher colour of the deciduous forest higher up the slope. They found the big bull standing alone on the edge of the thicket. "The two bulls have parted company and gone their separate ways. This will make the hunt easier for us," Osman said softly, and led them forward. The elephant was drowsing quietly, fanning his huge ears, rocking gently from one foot to the other. He was angled away from them, and his head was lowered, so that the thorn scrub reached to his lower lip and hid his tusks from view. The Agajirs reined in the horses to rest them before beginning the hunt. The breeze was steady and favourable, and there was no reason to hurry. Penrod rested with the horses. He squatted on his haunches and drank from the water-skin that Al-Nur unstrapped from the pommel of his saddle and dropped to the ground beside him. Suddenly the bull shook his head so that his ears clapped loudly, then reached out with his trunk to pluck a bunch of kitar blossom. When he lifted his head to stuff the yellow flowers into the back of his throat, he revealed his tusks. They were perfectly matched, long and thick. The hunters stirred and murmured in appreciation. "This is a fine animal. This is an honourable bull." They all looked to Osman Atalan to see whom he would choose for the honour, each hoping it would be himself. "Al-Nur," said Osman, and Al-Nur pushed his mount forward eagerly, only to slump again in the saddle when his master went on, "Slip the leash off Abd Jis." Penrod came to his feet with surprise, and Al-Nur removed the rope from around his neck. "It is too great an honour for an infidel slave," Al-Nur whispered enviously. Osman ignored his protest. He drew his sword and reversed it before he handed it to Penrod. "Kill this bull for me," he ordered. Penrod tested the balance and weight of the blade, cutting with it forehanded, then backhanded. He spun it in the air and caught it with his left hand, then cut and thrust again. He turned back to Osman on Al-Buk. Penrod was balanced on the balls of his bare feet. He held the sword in the guard position. His expression was grim. The blade was steady as if fixed in the jaws of a steel vice, pointed at the caliph's chest. Osman Atalan was unarmed and within the sweep of Penrod's sword arm. Their eyes locked. The Agajirs urged their mounts forward and their hands rested on their sword hilts. Penrod brought the sword slowly to his lips and kissed the flat of the blade. "It is a fine weapon," he said. "Use it wisely," Osman advised him quietly. Penrod turned away up the slope towards where the bull elephant stood. His bare feet made no sound on the stony earth, and he stepped lightly. He felt the breeze chill the sweat on the back of his neck. He used its direction to guide him as he angled in behind the bull. It was an enormous creature. At the shoulder it stood over twice his own height. Penrod had in mind every word of Osman's advice as he studied the hind legs. He could clearly make out the tendons beneath the grey and riven hide. They were thicker than his thumb, and as the beast rocked gently, they tightened and relaxed. He fastened his gaze on them and moved up quickly. Unexpectedly, the bull humped his back and braced both back legs. From the pouch of loose skin between the back legs, his penis dropped out and dangled until the tip almost touched the ground. It was longer than the span of Penrod's outstretched arms, and as thick as his forearm. The bull began to urinate, a powerful yellow stream that hosed out a shallow trench in the hard earth. The smell was rank and strong in the noonday heat. Penrod closed in to within 3 yards of the bull's haunches and stood poised, the sword lifted. Then he ran forward and swung the blade, aiming 2 handspans above the bull's right heel. It sliced down to the bone, and with a rubbery snap, the tendon parted. In the same movement, Penrod stepped across to the other leg, reversed his blade, and cut again. He saw the recoil of the severed tendon under the thick hide and jumped back. The crippled bull squealed and dropped heavily to his hindquarters in a sitting position, with both back legs paralyzed. Behind him, Penrod heard the Agajirs shout in acclamation. He watched the jets of blood squirting from the twin wounds. The bull's struggles to regain his feet aggravated the flow. It would not be long. The bull saw him and swung his head to face Penrod. He tried to drag himself forward, but his movements were awkward and ineffectual. Penrod retreated before him, watching until he was certain that the bull was mortally wounded, then turned and walked unhurriedly back towards the group of watching horsemen. He had covered half the distance when another elephant squealed on his right flank. The sound was so unexpected that he wheeled to face it. All this time the second younger bull had been standing nearby, also asleep on its feet. The kitar bush had concealed it, but at the cries and struggles of its companion it burst out of the dense thorn bush at full charge, pugnaciously seeking a focus for its alarm and anger. It saw Penrod immediately and swung towards him, rolling back the tips of his huge ears and coiling its trunk against its chest in a threatening attitude. It trumpeted wildly. As it began its charge, the ground trembled under its weight. Penrod glanced around swiftly for some avenue of retreat. There was no point in running towards the group of horsemen. They could offer him no help and would gallop away before he reached them. Even to climb into one of the tall trees that grew nearby would be of no avail. Standing on its back legs, the bull could reach even to the top branches to pull him down, or it could knock over the whole tree almost effortlessly. He thought of the ravine they had crossed a short distance back. It was so narrow and deep that he might crawl down into it beyond the bull's reach. He whirled and ran. Faintly, he heard the ribald shouts of the Agajirs. "Run, dung beetle! Spread your wings and fly! Pray to your Christian god, infidel! Behold, the fields of paradise lie before you!" He heard the elephant crashing through the scrub behind him. Then he saw the opening of the ravine 100 paces ahead. He was at the top of his own speed, his tempered, hardened legs driving so hard that the elephant was overhauling him only gradually. But he knew in his heart that it would catch him. Then he heard pounding hooves close behind him. He could not help glancing back. The bull was towering over him like a dark cliff, already uncoiling its trunk to swipe him down. The blow would smash bone. Once he was on the ground, the bull would kneel on him, crushing him against the hard earth until every bone in his body was smashed, then stabbing those long ivory shafts repeatedly through what remained of his body. He tore away his gaze and looked ahead. Still the sound of hooves crescendoed. Without slackening his run, Penrod braced himself for the shattering blow that must surely come. Then the hooves were alongside him, and he saw movement from the corner of his eye. The black bulk of Al-Buk was overtaking him. Osman was leaning forward over his withers and pumping the reins. He had kicked his foot out of the nearside stirrup, and the empty iron bumped against Al-Buk's flank. "Come on, Abjiz," Osman invited him. "I have not finished with you yet." With his right hand, Penrod snatched the stirrup leather and twisted it round his wrist. Instantly, he was jerked off his feet, and he allowed himself to be carried away by the racing stallion. As he swung on the end of the leather, he looked back. The bull was still at full charge behind them, but losing ground to the stallion. At last he abandoned the chase and, still squealing with rage, turned aside into the kitar thorn. As he ran off, he ripped down branches from the trees in his path in frustration and hurled them high into the air. He vanished over the crest of the hill. Osman reined in Al-Buk, and Penrod released the stirrup leather. He still held the hilt of the sword in his left hand. Osman threw his leg over the stallion's neck and dropped to the ground, landing like a cat in front of him. The other Agajirs were widely scattered, and for the moment the two were alone. Osman held out his right hand. "You have no further need of that steel," he said quietly. Penrod glanced down at the sword. "It grieves me to give it up." He reversed the weapon and slapped the hilt into Osman's right hand. "In God's name, you are a brave man and an even wiser one," Osman said, and brought out his left hand from behind his back. In it he held a fully cocked pistol. He thumbed the hammer and let it drop to half-cock, just as Al-Nur rode up. Al-Nur also jumped down and spontaneously embraced Penrod. "Two true strokes," he applauded him. "No man could have done it cleaner." They did not have time to wait for the tusks to rot free, so they chopped them out. It took until noon the next day to remove the long cone-shaped nerve from the cavity in the base of each. It was painstaking work. A slip of the blade would mar the ivory and reduce drastically its monetary and aesthetic value. They loaded them onto the pack horses, and when they rode into the main encampment, the drummers beat loud and the horns blared. The women, even the caliph's wife and his concubines, came out to watch. The men fired their rifles in the air, then crowded around the pack horse to marvel at the size of the tusks. "This must have been the father and grandfather of many great bulls," they told each other. Then they asked Osman Atalan, "Tell us, we beg you, exalted caliph, which hunter brought down this mighty beast?" "The one who was once known as Abdjiz, but who has now become the Agajir Abadan Riji." From then on, no man ever called Penrod Abdjiz again. That derogatory name was lost and forgotten. "Command us, Supreme One. What must we do with these tusks?" "I shall keep one in my tent to remind me of this day's sport. The other belongs to the Agajir who slew it." Early the following morning, when Osman Atalan emerged from his tent, he greeted his waiting Agajirs and discussed with them the usual business of the day, the route he intended to follow, and the purpose and object of the day's ride. Penrod squatted nearby with the horses, taking no part, until Osman called to him, "Your style of dress brings your companions into disrepute." Penrod stood up in surprise and looked down at his shift. Although he had washed it whenever an opportunity presented itself, it was stained and worn. He had no needle or thread with which to mend it, and the cloth was ripped by thorn and branch, worn threadbare with hard use. "I have become accustomed to this uniform. It suits me well enough, great Atalan." "It suits me not at all," said Osman, and clapped his hands. One of the house slaves came scurrying forward. He carried a folded garment. "Give it to Abadan Riji," Osman ordered him. and he knelt before Penrod and proffered the bundle. Penrod took it from him and shook it out. He saw that it was a clean, unworn jibba, and with it were a pair of sandals of tanned camel hide. "Put them on," said Osman. Penrod saw at once that the jibba was plain, not decorated with the ritual multicoloured patches that had such powerful political and religious significance and constituted a dervish uniform. He would not have donned the jibbas if it had. He stripped off his rags and slipped it over his head. It fitted him remarkably well, as did the sandals. Somebody had observed his size shrewdly. "That pleases me better," said Osman, and swung up easily into Al-Buk's saddle. Penrod moved up to his usual position at the stirrup, but Osman shook his head. "An Agajir is a horseman," he clapped again, and a groom led a saddled horse from behind the tent. It was a sturdy roan gelding that Penrod had noticed in the herd of spare horses. "Mount up," Osman ordered him, and he went into the saddle, then followed the group of riders into the forest. Penrod was conscious of his inferior rank in the band, so he kept well back. Over the first few miles, he assessed the roan under him. The horse had a comfortable gait and showed no vices. He would not be particularly fast. He could never outrun any of the other Agajirs. If Penrod ever tried to escape, they would run him down quickly enough. No great beauty, but a hard pounder with good temperament, he decided. It felt good to have a horse between his knees again. They rode on towards the Blue Mountains and the Abyssinian border. They were heading now directly for Galabat, the last dervish stronghold before the border. Though the mountains seemed close, they were still 10 days' ride ahead. Gradually they left the wilderness behind. There were no more signs of elephant or of the other great game animals. Soon they were passing through fields of durra and other cultivation and many small Sudanese villages. Then they started to climb through the foothills of the central massif. When they off-saddled to recite the midday prayers, Osman Atalan always left the others and spread his carpet in a shaded place that overlooked the next green valley. After he had prayed, he would usually eat alone. But that day he called Penrod and indicated that he should sit facing him on the Persian carpet. "Break bread with me," he invited. Al-Nur set out between them a dish of unleavened durra cakes and asida, and another dish of cold smoked antelope meat. He had hastily cut the throats of the animals before they had died from the lance wounds that had brought them down, so the flesh was halal. There was a smaller dish filled with coarse salt. Osman gave thanks to Allah and asked for his blessing on the food. Then he selected a morsel of smoked meat and with his right hand dipped it into the salt. He leaned forward and held it to Penrod's lips. Penrod hesitated. He was faced with a crucial decision. If he accepted food and salt from Osman's hand, it would constitute a pact between them. In the tradition of the tribes, it would be equivalent to a parole. If thereafter he tried to escape, or if he committed any warlike or aggressive act against Osman, he would break his word of honour. Swiftly he made his decision. "I am a Christian, not a Muslim. Also, I am not Beja. For me, this is not a binding oath." He accepted the offering, chewed and swallowed, then picked out a scrap of venison, salted it, and offered it to Osman. The caliph ate it and nodded his thanks. They ate slowly, savouring the meal, and their easy conversation concerned the affairs that absorbed them both: war, hunting, and the pursuit of arms. At first it was ride-ranging, then became more specific, as Osman asked how the British trained their troops and what qualities their commanders looked for in their officers. "Like you, we are a warlike people. Most of our kings were warriors," Penrod explained. "This I have heard," Osman nodded. "I have also seen with my own eyes how your people fight. Where do they learn these skills?" "There are a people called the French, a neighbouring tribe. We have sport with them on occasion. There is always trouble in some part of the empire that must be controlled. During periods of peace, we have colleges, which have been established for many generations to train our line and staff officers. Two are famous, the Royal Military Academy at Woolwich and the Royal Military College at Camberley. We also have a school for our warriors, Osman nodded. We call it the Desert. Penrod laughed, then agreed. Ha! The battlefield is the best training school. But we have found the academic study of the art of war invaluable too. You see, most of the great generals of all the ages, from Alexander to Wellington, have written of their campaigns. There is much in which they are able to instruct us. When they rode on eastwards, Osman summoned Penrod to ride at his side, and they continued their discussion animatedly. At times they became heated. Penrod was describing how Bonaparte had been unable to break the British square at Waterloo, and Osman had mocked him lightly. We Arabs have not studied at any college, and yet, unlike this Frenchman, we broke your square at Aboukir. Penrod rose to the bait, as Osman had intended he should. You never broke us. You penetrated locally, but the square held and healed itself, then became a trap for your Emir al-Salida, his sons, and 1,000 of his men. They argued with the freedom of blood brothers. But when their voices rose, the Agajirs looked at each other uneasily and pressed close to be ready to intervene if their caliph was threatened. Osman waved them back. He reined in on the skyline of another ridge in the series that climbed like a giant staircase towards the mountains. Before us lies the land of the Abyssinians, our enemies for many centuries past. If you were my general, and I asked you to seize the territory as far as Gondar, then hold it against the rage of Emperor John. Tell me how you, with your schoolroom studies, would accomplish this task. It was the kind of problem that Penrod had studied at the Staff Officers' College. He took up the challenge with enthusiasm. How many men will you give me? 25,000, Osman replied. How many does the Emperor have to bring against me? Maybe 10,000 at Gondar, but another 300,000 beyond the mountains at Aksum in the highlands. They will have to descend through the high passes to bring me to battle, will they not? Then I must invest Gondar swiftly, and once the city is contained, I will not pause to reduce it, but I will drive on hard to seal the mouths of the passes before the reinforcements can debouch into the open ground. They discussed this problem in detail, considering every possible response to the attack. Their discussion continued unflaggingly over the rest of the march to Galabat. It was only when they came in sight of the town that it occurred to Penrod that it had not been an academic discussion, and that this journey was a prelude to the Dervish invasion of the Kingdom of Abyssinia. Osman was calling on his training as a military adviser. So, the Mahdi's jihad did not end at Khartoum, Penrod realized. Abdullah, he knows that he must fight or he will languish and perish. Then he considered how much damage he had unwittingly done by giving encouragement and expert advice to Osman. Even if the Dervish triumphs here at Gondar, Abdullah, he will not be satisfied. He will turn his eyes on Eritrea, and he won't stop there. He cannot stop. He will never stop until he is forcibly stopped. That will not happen until Abdullahi has aroused the wrath of the civilized world, he decided. In my own humble way, I may have done something to help bring that about. He smiled coldly. There are exciting days ahead.